everyone, and welcome to this next episode of the Sustainable Connections podcast. I'm Mark Lee. I'm responsible for the ERM Sustainability Institute and the host of these sessions. If you've listened to Sustainable Connections before, you'll know the premise. We try to bring together people in the field of corporate sustainability that ERM works with and respects and admires, and to explore, you know, kind of how we tackle sustainability challenges together. I'm going to continue that theme today under the broad umbrella of corporate sustainability disclosure. And I have with me Coy Garrison of Steptoe, and also Beth Weick, who is part of ERM, another partner like me, who is responsible for our certification and verification services. I really want to hear your voices immediately and get you each to introduce yourself, and then we'll get into the enhancement and standardization of climate-related disclosures, the new SEC rule. But first, Coy, welcome. Thank you for joining us. And please tell us a tiny bit about yourself and about Steptoe.
Yeah, thanks, Mark, for having me. And it's a pleasure to be here with you. So I'm a partner at Steptoe, and I advise public companies and their boards on their SEC reporting and disclosure requirements. So that includes your typical requirements, but also includes your growing area of ESG, right? Which is why we're here today to talk about the climate rule. Prior to joining Steptoe in 2022, I'd spent about a decade at the SEC in a number of different positions in the Division of Corporation Finance, which is the group that reviews IPOs, reviews 10Ks, and the like, as well as serving as counsel to Commissioner Hester Peirce, including during the negotiation of the proposal of this climate rule. So very excited to talk about the evolution of the rule and how we've gotten to where we are today.
So you were really in the eye of the storm when some of this was developing. And just before I go to Beth, I mean, at what point as a child did your dreams of working for the SEC emerge? Did you really have a plan coming through law school, like that's where I want to be? Or how did that happen? Why this part of law?
You know, I discovered securities law while in law school, and I never thought I would be into it. And I absolutely loved it. I think securities law is an area that you can practice in your entire career and never get bored. I discovered very quickly my affection for the topic and also my affection for the agencies. I had the pleasure of interning there in law school and then working right out of law school for some time. It was pretty clear from the beginning of my legal career that securities law was the path for me.
Oh, fantastic. Your affection and passion will undoubtedly be to our benefit today. Beth, I want to turn to you and please introduce yourself as well and explain this piece of the ERM universe that we often default to calling CVS, but means Certification and Verification Services. What's that all about?
Happy to. I'm Beth Weick. I am responsible for our global corporate assurance team. So what we do is assure all things non-financial against standards. And we have a great team that's been doing that with very deep subject matter expertise and understanding of the international assurance standards that are typically used to do assurance. I've been with ERM and ERM CVS now for 27 years, doing and leading our assurance team for about 7-8 years. We were also engaged in the development of the SEC rule. We provided some input in its development and also provided substantial comment after the draft was released. So that was pretty exciting.
And similar to the question that I asked Coy, Beth, but like, how did you make a pivot into assurance specifically?
That's an easy one for me. So I spent most of my career at ERM being an ESG subject matter expert. So air quality, land use, biology was actually in my training. Eventually, I got tired of creating work and decided it would be really fun to quiz everybody else. And I love words and what they mean and the nuances of them, and had also toyed with being a lawyer for a little bit. So it's just the perfect kind of combination of skepticism that I come by naturally and subject matter expertise. I sincerely love this type of work, much like Coy was saying, he knew where he belonged once he found it. This is also where I belong.
I love that skepticism and expertise were the magic recipe in this case. We'll benefit from that, no doubt, as well. Well, let's kind of plunge in. And I signaled to folks listening that we're going to get into climate-related disclosure and specifically the regulatory side of this. Listeners will probably know that the SEC, after a couple of years' delay, released its final climate disclosure rules for issuers. They're called the Enhancement and Standardization of Climate-Related Disclosures, but I think we'll just default to the SEC climate rules on this call. Koi, I want to come to you first on the kind of timing. This took 2 years after the original draft. Other jurisdictions definitely moved earlier, and many of them have stricter rules. So why was the SEC release still so anticipated, and what makes it so important?
Yeah, so I think, you know, there was a lot of attention on this SEC release because the frameworks for climate-related information for companies in the U.S. has been really fragmented for quite some time, right? It's a newer disclosure area, or at least a disclosure area where there's been enhanced attention, I'll say, in the last decade. I'm sure Beth can correct me on the length of time this has been kicking around. But, you know, for quite some time, there was private market ordering of different voluntary frameworks existed, right? And I think a lot of companies raised their hand and were looking around and saying, well, gosh, maybe we should have a central regulator like the SEC create a central rule of the road so that we don't have to comply with all these different frameworks. And maybe this will streamline the requirements, make it easier. You also had a number of stakeholders, sometimes investors, sometimes not, asking for more consistent information and the like. So, you know, I think for many years, the SEC kind of stayed out of it, thinking that private ordering should take its time and place and mature. But with Chair Gensler's tenure at the SEC, he made it a priority and, you know, obviously issued the proposal in March 2022. And it took some time. That this is a fast evolving area. I mean, as the SEC rulemaking process started, the ISSB got stood up, started issuing standards themselves and the like. So this, you know, the ground is shifting underneath the SEC as it was proposing the rules and looking at it. So it's not surprising that it took a long time for them to consider, as well as the significant legal hurdles and questions about the SEC's authority to issue rules here, and you know, and the different legal structures around the SEC is limited in what it can require by statute. That's different than, let's say, the European approach, where the European Commission is voting in a whole new regulatory regime and telling its regulators to move forward. That's a different process, right? So I think the differences in jurisdictions also kind of explain the different approaches and why it's taken different amounts of time.
And so after that time and fitting it into the regulatory process in the U.S., if the ambition was less fragmentation, maybe Koi, give us a top level. Do you think it succeeded? And what are a couple of the most notable elements of the new climate rules?
I'll start with the notable elements, maybe, and that'll help guide the conversation on the other question, right? So I think the biggest item that people tend to focus in on is the emissions disclosure, right? And that changed pretty drastically from the proposal. The final rule would require scope 1 and scope 2 emissions, if material, for large accelerated filers and then a subset of accelerated filers, as long as you're not a smaller reporting company or emerging growth company. Those are all defined terms in the statute about how big you are depending on your revenue, your asset size, and the like. While scope 1 and scope 2 will now be required if material, the scope 3 disclosure requirement dropped out from the proposal, right? And that's caught a lot of attention. Those are big ticket items there. And I know we'll get into the assurance requirements and the like. But even outside of the emissions, there's still huge segments of disclosures required by the rule, right? So climate-related risks and its material impacts on your business, your strategy, your results of operations, how this plays out in your governance and your risk management strategy. There's very prescriptive disclosure requirements included in here, as well as footnote financial statement information, which will be very time intensive, very costly, will involve auditors and the like. So the rule itself covers a lot of ground. It's pretty breathtaking in scope, even though it's been pared back from the proposal. But I think when you get into the nitty-gritty details of the rules, you know, one of the big changes was the making it explicitly clear in most disclosure requirements that there's a materiality threshold, right? You only have to disclose this if it's material to the company. When you do that, you know, the beauty of the materiality threshold is it allows for the individual facts and circumstances of a company to take hold. But I think that also undercuts the stated goal of creating consistent, comparable information, right? That probably undercuts the ultimate goal here. But in my mind, it was a necessary change from the proposal, because if the SEC doesn't tie its disclosure requirements to materiality, then I really think it's veering outside its stated purview that Congress gave it.
Okay, so many things in there. And we're going to loop back to a number of the things you said across risk and materiality. Scope three, I'm certain. Just one reflection, and Beth, I'm coming towards you. For all of the reaction after a two-year delay, I think many voices said, wow, this final rule is considerably weaker than what had originally been proposed. What you just ran through reminded me still how massive it is in scope and how much it will demand. So maybe it's that we shouldn't underestimate it, even though it was pared down. But Beth, before we go down those other pathways, what were some of your reactions to it, sort of headlines for you, whether you'd emphasize the same things COI did or point in different directions?
Yeah, I would emphasize a lot of the same things, but I do think that where some things have been explicitly called out, for example, for Scope 3, where it's not required to report it directly, but it does require that you're reporting material goals and targets and progress against those goals and targets. And for some companies, Scope 3 will be material from a goal and target perspective. I don't know that I would consider it watered down. I would consider it rephrased or reframed, where you're still getting the material information, but maybe taking out some of what appears to be a bite. It's a win for those who want to see more disclosure, and you don't have to report it if it's not material to you. Something else I saw that struck me is some companies aren't required to report their greenhouse gas emissions and get assurance. But if you are one of those large accelerated filers or accelerated filers and are going to have to eventually have assurance, if you're doing it now voluntarily, you're still required to report that. So that's raised some questions for me around whether some companies might decide for legal reasons, and would love to hear from COI on that, if maybe they won't report externally or get assurance while they're doing it voluntarily now because of potential added risk.
Yeah, you know, I think it's a great example of the myriad of questions that companies really are going to have to grapple with of what are you already voluntarily disclosing out in the marketplace? And now with the potential of increased liability by including that in an SEC report, do you want to continue disclosing that information? So I think the good news is that companies have time to make that determination if as they move forward, of just because you've been disclosing voluntarily something in a particular manner doesn't mean you need to continue to do so. Maybe it means you continue to do so with certain safeguards in place. So I think each company is going to depend on the facts and circumstances, how they're going to approach that. But I think it is something that needs to be considered of, you know, just because you're disclosing something in one venue, as soon as you disclose it in an SEC report, you subject it to an incredibly enhanced rigor, right? Like it needs to go through your disclosure controls and procedures. There's more eyes involved. It's enhanced liability. It's just a whole new ballgame. So I think it's something that during this transition period, they have a couple months, you know, basically to figure this out in the next year, year and a half or so.
Yeah, one of my colleagues framed it as we're moving from an era of experimentation to an era of kind of professional practice. And the level of rigor that comes with that is obviously incredible. Beth, I wanted to let COI pick up your question, but you were, I think, getting us into the question of the boundaries, right? And part of this is typified by Scope 3. Scope 3 is out of the final rule, unless it's material to the organization. And can you go a bit farther with that? What are the other boundaries that apply to what companies need to do to respond that you think people should be aware of?
So when companies are talking about their greenhouse gas emissions, many are reporting against the greenhouse gas protocol, right? Which either include operational control or financial control generally as your reporting boundaries. Greenhouse gas emissions need to be included within that boundary is guided generally by those two definitions, right? But in the SEC rule in the original draft, it said that you needed to report in line with your consolidated financial reporting boundary, which is sometimes different from the operational control and even from the financial control boundaries that are in the greenhouse gas protocol. So it added a level of shock and like, oh my gosh, I didn't even see that. And what does that mean? And as a result of the final rule, it was made more clear what the boundary expectation is, and companies can keep using the operational control boundary that many do use to report, But it's again another one of those tricky spots where it says you can do this, but you also have to tell us if there's a material difference between operational control reporting or your consolidated financial reporting. So you have to be able to calculate it and articulate it and decide if it's material or not, but still allows you to do it the way you used to do it. So kind of now you do it both ways. So it could be that companies decide they don't want to have to do both and they just go with the consolidated financial accounting boundaries, which is what was proposed in the original. That said, there are other regulations, and we're going to talk about those later, like CSRD in California, and they allow you to do operational control. So there won't necessarily be consistency across all.
Coy, if you have anything to add on boundaries, very interested. I'm also interested to take you to the current status of the rule. This thing came into life a few weeks ago, and on the day that it emerged, multiple attorneys general filed suit to challenge it, and it has currently been stayed by the Fifth Circuit here in the U.S. So you mentioned you were there in the commission during some of the drafting of the rule, working with one of the commissioners, and you've watched the change from draft to final rule. And I wonder, in part, are the final rules more likely to survive legal challenge because they're not as sweeping as what was in the draft? Or just how do we interpret this current state of new rule, case lawsuits filed, stayed? How do we even observe this intelligently?
Let's start with the most recent on the status of the rule, because it literally is changing by the day here. It's fast-moving litigation. So a number of litigants challenged the SEC, not only in the Fifth Circuit and the Eighth Circuit, 11th Circuit, DC Circuit, and perhaps one more. And when that happens, an agency has the option of going to a court and having the court literally conduct a lottery, picking the lotto ball numbers for who's going to win money, right? Like they literally put the balls in a cage. They have witnesses to make sure there's no tampering. And they do this. And so that's what happened. The SEC said, this rule has been challenged in so many different circuits. We want it all consolidated in one circuit to decide. So that happened. And the Eighth Circuit won the lottery. So the Eighth Circuit will be hearing the challenges here. So the Fifth Circuit stay that you mentioned subsequently was just lifted by the Fifth Circuit as a procedural matter, because now the case and controversy is before the Eighth Circuit, not the Fifth Circuit, right? Just this morning, petitioners from that case that had been successful to get the stay in the Fifth Circuit just petitioned the Eighth Circuit for the exact same stay, saying that it's the same arguments, same law controls in both circuits. And so we'll see what the Eighth Circuit does with that in the coming weeks. Next steps, too, is we'll be waiting for briefing schedules, the more administrative process from the Eighth Circuit of how they're going to proceed. Taking a broader view of, okay, substantively, what are we dealing with here? The rules change a lot from proposal to final. Does that help them actually solve their problems here? I guess my answer would be yes. The final rule, by tying many disclosure requirements to this materiality concept, and reducing the amount of information required, certainly on the emissions and other areas, certainly helps the SEC's argument. Speaking personally, my view is that the challengers still have a winning argument. For me, when you look at the breathtaking scope of these disclosures, even with them being pared back, we kind of just tick through them. I mean, this is almost a 900-page rule. And even though it's less prescriptive than it was a proposal, it's still very prescriptive. It is just a significant amount of rule. And I think, I don't want to get into too much detail, but there's a lot of talk about the major questions doctrine, which is this constitutional principle that's emerged in recent Supreme Court cases over the last few years that basically says when there's matters of vast political and economic significance, the court really expects Congress to state clearly that an agency has that authority here, right? And so there's no doubt that the challengers will come under that doctrine, and they're going to look to the SEC's rulemaking authority. They're going to look to the statute. The statute gives the SEC very broad authority in writing rules, but there is a limiting principle. That limiting principle is it must be tied to the public interest or protection of investors. Obviously, you can make very broad arguments about what is in the public interest, what is for the protection of investors. But I think when you look at historically how the SEC has interpreted that, they have always tied it to the financial condition of the company. In fact, in the 70s, the SEC considered some broad-ranging climate-related disclosures, and at the time decided that it would not move forward, that it needed to keep the information more tied to the financial condition and the like. Speaking more broadly, just this will cost billions of dollars in the aggregate, as the economic analysis shows, even from the SEC's estimates. So it's going to have a huge impact on the economy. Climate change is obviously a hot political topic that Congress has been weighing in on and the like. So I think there's plenty of ammo here still that a court could find that this exceeds the SEC's authority. Now, before you go and say, well, Coy told me it's going to be shut down, don't worry about it.
That's not what I hear yet. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a couple important caveats. One, you know, obviously this is just me guessing, and who knows how these courts will decide these matters, right? There's plenty of smart lawyers on both sides are going to be making very brilliant arguments, and it'll be a long fight, no doubt. But second, you know, even the timeline for implementation is such that you really have to be collecting information in 2025 to be prepared to disclose under this rule. So that means mapping out how to approach this now, regardless of any court challenge, is the right approach. And building through, right? And I think, and then the question is, does some parts of the rule survive but not others? You know, you may have some disclosure requirements stay, but some others not. So you can't put your head in the sand and just pretend like, you know, that it's going down, the details of which can be hammered out over the coming months as the picture becomes clearer.
I'd like to add that even if the SEC rule does change, there are a lot of other regulations that are requiring very similar or the same things. So it's another reason to keep proceeding in your preparation for this rule, because it will help you for others.
Yeah, 100%. And I think we'll go to those other jurisdictions in just a moment. I was thinking, reflecting on what you said, Coy, that, you know, we should all hear that the challenges are substantive, you know, that these are meaningful, that this is a stretch in some ways for the SEC, and it'll be sort of hard fought. Listening to you talk about, you know, the interest of investors part, I think we know as observers that investors have been creating demand for climate-related disclosures that are more consistent and higher quality. So I'm sure that will play through. And when I hear the reference to what the rule will cost in the billions of dollars, you know, spread across all companies in the economy, I'd be remiss, I think, if I didn't say that we know that the impacts of climate itself are going to cost far, far more. So there's some question there about how much to invest to address climate change. Beth, let's pick up your thread there and let's go to how the SEC rule compares to some of the others that have come from other jurisdictions. And we've already mentioned in the course of this call the California rules that emerged in the course of 2023, and also the CSRD, which many listeners will probably recognize is the European Corporate Sustainability Reporting Directive. Starting with you, Beth, how do you think they compare? What do we take from one to the other?
For those that are going to be required to comply with all, it makes sense to start with the broadest one, which would be CSRD, that covers obviously much more than the SEC regulation and the California. If it were me and I were needing to plan for these, I would keep the biggest one in mind and then scale down and back. So you have one good set of data that you can pull from to meet all the needs.
Thanks, Beth. Great. And Coy, same question towards you. You know, California, the CSRD, these jurisdictions have been talking to one another. They are all drawing on some similar guidelines and standards, the Task Force on Climate-Related Disclosures, the Greenhouse Gas Protocol that we've mentioned. What's notable about how the SEC compares to the other rules, and how do they perhaps reinforce one another?
You start with where you know you have disclosure obligations. So if you have disclosure obligations under the CSRD, well, starting there is great. Unfortunately, it's not going to get you all the way, right? You can't simply just say, I have these disclosures under the CSRD and then provide it for either the SEC or potentially California. I guess we'll take them in turn. So the SEC rules, there is no substituted compliance. If you are a foreign issuer, for example, or a large US company that reports under a different regime, and can't simply tell the SEC, here are my disclosures under this other regime, and we're fine, right? So you still have to tailor your disclosures to the SEC. Under the California rules, slightly more nuanced, I believe there is room for substitute compliance. The legislation directly indicated that substitute compliance with the ISSB would be appropriate. But California rules, we don't have the actual regulations. We only have the legislation, right? We have the California Air Resources Board needs to promulgate rules for us to really know the details. So I think you start with what is in front of you, what obligations you have, but you're going to likely have to have different disclosure policies and procedures in place for the different regimes. And so appreciating that now and trying to leverage where you can is important, but each one seems nuanced and different enough that you'll be able to borrow some of the work from the others, but they're going to have nuanced differences, which will make compliance more difficult.
Yes, we have to talk about materiality, right? And double materiality and who the intended users are. That's another big, big difference between CSRD and the SEC in California. So there are multiple perspectives to take into account while you're preparing for the CSRD.
I hear a massive collective sigh out there in the ether from corporate issuers who are listening, who hoped that the answer to the prior question was going to be, if you file in compliance with the CSRD, you will just be able to send a copy to California and the SEC. And I'm sure there will be overlap, but it's going to take careful study of each of these rules to navigate this terrain.
It was such a great point that was just raised. I just wanted to underscore, because that double materiality concept is going to result in a lot more disclosure under the CSRD than what the SEC disclosure rules would require, which is linked to the financial materiality from a reasonable investor perspective, right? And so again, this gets back to the earlier conversation of, this is where you really want to discuss with your consultants, with your lawyers, do you want to take enhanced liability by using disclosure that you prepared under a different regime and put it into an SEC filing? To underscore that point, because it'll be really important here.
Yeah, that question I think is going to be enormous. And we is working with multiple clients on materiality exercises and double materiality exercises. And folks hopefully know that the double materiality is the CSRD approach. We're finishing a piece of work for several people kind of in parallel right now and finding that there are hundreds of impacts, risks, and opportunities identified in their double materiality exercise for each company. So the scope of what double materiality potentially brings into play. And of course, CSRD goes beyond just climate. So there's that also. It is massive. And I couldn't agree more, Coy, that people won't just be able to drag materiality from one of the rules to the other. Beth, I was going to go to you and I want to delve into your assurance expertise. There are notes and guidance about assurance in the new SEC rule, and I would love to hear how you interpret the assurance implications, and also who and how is going to be able to provide the kind of assurance that's going to be required, assuming that the rule comes into play.
The other rules we were just talking about require assurance anyway, so that's going to happen. There are a lot of companies right now that are voluntarily having assurance of their greenhouse gas data and other ESG related data, both at a limited level and a reasonable level, which are kind of just different levels of depth that you go to when you're testing and evaluating data in its most simple form. So I think that the need is going to continue to increase as the regulations are requiring it. Something good that happened between the draft and the final rule, the original rule allowed for use of specific auditing assurance standards, attestation standards that some companies like ERMCVS already use, like ISA 3000, right? That's a globally accepted assurance standard. What it precluded was the use of the ISO standard. And now the final rule has allowed that as an assurance standard. And what that means is that companies will have more options in who their assurance providers are. And that's good for the companies because of that increased demand. There's concern that there aren't enough assurance providers in the world with the right subject matter expertise to do the work. And I think that there are, and I think that companies need to just make really good choices for themselves while they're deciding who is going to help perform that assurance for them.
That is super interesting. And just that notion that the assurance world that can be applied to this is broadening because the standards that can be used to assure under the rule have been kind of opened out. If somebody wants to take their first steps towards assurance readiness,
yes,
where would you say they should start?
I would start with the topics that are going to be material to you, whether it's single materiality or double materiality, and do a pre-assurance, essentially going through a mock assurance exercise and testing all your internal controls, because internal controls are what's going to be the driver and make things easier for you to move from limited to reasonable assurance. So important that you get those right now. I know there are a lot of companies looking at all these vast data requirements and wondering if they should have a tool, or not even if they should, but which tool are they going to use to achieve this data reporting efforts. And so when you're picking those kind of companies, you want to make sure that you're embedding those controls that you need into your process. And as you're marrying your financial reporting data tools into your ESG related tools, making sure that they're talking to each other and meeting all those control requirements. And so I think there's a lot of kind of foundational work that needs to be done. And still some companies aren't as fluent in ESG as they are in finance and reporting and what that means and all the nuance. So there's still a lot of education that's yet to be done, which is very, very, very important. And really, having ESG data that's as high quality as financial data is so important in making really good business decisions, regardless if you're just doing it to manage the risk or looking for opportunities, that it's important that transparency is available and reliable data exists to make good decisions.
I think issuers listening will think, how long is it going to take me to do pre-assurance? Let's make an assumption that this is a company of reasonable scale, and they already have a sustainability report, and they already reply to ratings like CDP, so that they have climate disclosures going on. If somebody's starting there, can you even give them a range of time, Mark, that it will take to prepare a pre-assurance?
That's a trick question. So let me back up by saying different companies get to their numbers still in very different ways.
Yeah.
So we talk about, we can do assurance. You can do assurance over client data that's literally still in spreadsheets. Like a plant, for example, gives information to corporate and corporate consolidates the information. Or you can do assurance for a company that has one central database and everything is automated. So I'd say really, the amount of time depends on the maturity of the governance structure that exists within the company. And even when you have really good governance, if you don't have buy-in that the quality of the data needs to be really, really good, you can have some underlying messes that get uncovered. And assurance, pre-assurance, and readiness really depends on the scope. So if you're looking at CSRD and you're trying to do pre-assurance on all the material topics under CSRD, is going to take you a bit longer and more human power than you would need if you're looking just at scope 1 and 2 greenhouse gas emissions for a generally straightforward company. It does depend. I can tell you for something relatively simple-ish, it's about 3 to 5 months for very limited scope and a cleanish company. But really what you get out of that pre-assurance kind of effort is a management report. So basically a list of findings, right? And you go away and you fix everything. And that's the part that actually takes longer, depending on the gap you have between your readiness.
Yeah, no, I think a great answer to a trick question, Beth, and appreciate that. I knew in advance there was not going to be it will take 74 days,
right.
But you've given us a sense of the scale of the task, and the it depends, of course, applies. Coy, I want to come back to you. And I realized actually with one of the comments you made earlier in the session, you talked about this morning. And I don't usually date stamp the podcast because we don't quite know when they're going to come out, but I think that made it important. So for folks who were listening closely, when we were talking about the challenges to the new SEC climate rules moving to the 8th Circuit, we are recording on March 27th. So if you're listening to this a few weeks down the road and wondering when that happened and trying to track, March 27th is your reference date. And then Coy, still in the legal space, and this will probably bring us towards a close for today's conversation. So the rule is out. It's being challenged. To some degree, there's a kind of limbo because of that, but other rules and demands for climate disclosure exist, be that CSRD, other regulation, be that investor and stakeholder demand. What should companies do now? Are there a few steps you'd say issuers do this anyways? You know, here's your best preparation recipe.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So I think a couple steps every company should be doing right now, regardless of the legal challenges to the SEC rule. And by the way, the legal challenges to the California rule. I think anyone that may be impacted by these rules needs to be performing a gap assessment right now of what their requirements are, what their obligations under these different rule sets would be, and what they are actually doing today. What are they disclosing in their sustainability reports? How are they collecting information? What do they care about, right? And I think that's just a vital step that should be taken. Second, you know, the follow-up to that is developing a strategy of how would you fill those gaps? Mm-hmm. What needs to be done? Do you need to hire new people? Do you need to implement new controls and procedures? You know, and that's where each company is going to have different approaches, right? Some companies might be ready to move forward immediately. Some might then say, I want to do the following steps until we know for sure that this rule is going to be finalized or the like, right? But it allows you to put yourself in the best position for compliance. And as you mentioned, it's not only the regulatory obligations in this space. So many companies will want to provide this information because of the demands from investors, because of the demands from different stakeholders. So if companies are in that bucket, well, then this provides a nice framework through which to start improving and enhancing your disclosures right now, right? I mean, I think a lot of companies benefit right now from the voluntary framework because you get to pick and choose mm-hmm. what you disclose and when. And so starting to bring some more discipline and rigor around it, even if it doesn't ultimately end up to the same level of an SEC public company disclosure obligation, is an important thing to be thinking about and something you can do right now.
If it takes 18 months to get through them or whatever period of time, is there any way to anticipate what that might do to compliance timelines on the other side? Do those automatically push back a certain distance if a rule's been held up in the courts for a certain amount of time? How does that work?
Yeah, so there's no way to predict with any certainty exactly how that would play out, right? I mean, I think a couple different ways it could would be if, for example, the Eighth Circuit issues a stay on implementation of the rules, well, then that would pause indefinitely until the court says otherwise, the effective date of the rules and the compliance dates. You know, you run the risk of a court could come out a month before the compliance date saying everything's A-OK, there's no problem here, and then you're stuck having to comply, right? At the same time, the court can also tell the SEC at the same time that, you know, you have to revise the compliance dates, or the SEC may do it on themselves. But the long way of saying there's no certainty that the compliance dates will be moved back. I mean, I think certainly is within the realm of possibility. But I think sadly that you can't get any comfort at this stage that the compliance dates will in fact be moved back on what timeline.
If I think back what each of you have said in the last, especially 10, 15 minutes about pre-assurance, about gap analysis, about, you know, preparing your climate-related disclosures for the rigor of scrutiny that will come in different forms, be that from regulators, be that from investors, be it from others. It seems to me that even while we wait to see exactly how the SEC rule plays through, there is so much to do in this space for everybody in the private sector, and that we can kind of anticipate there'll be more. There'll be more scrutiny, there'll be more challenge, there'll be more debate. My personal view is that it's just a question of the pace at which this all moves forward as we grapple with climate and its impacts. And the SEC rule is part of that. What I really want to end on is a huge thank you both to you, Coy, and Steptoe for this and for the other work we've had the opportunity to do with you and to draw on Steptoe as an expert partner. We're so appreciative. And Beth, it is always fantastic to have you bring your skepticism and expertise, as you framed it earlier, to a conversation and help illuminate it as you did today, well beyond assurance as well. So thank you, Coy. Thank you, Beth. Thanks to everyone who listens to Sustainable Connections. You can find us on all of the usual platforms. Also, all of the previous episodes are on erm.com if you want to listen to those. And we always love to hear feedback. Thanks so much.